These are the oldest stories, online at oldeststories.net. There exists uncertainty about when exactly the Neo-Assyrian Empire began. I said last episode that it starts with Ashur-dan in 935 BCE. Others would put it all the way up to 883 with the reign of Ashurnasirpal, who we'll get to in due time. Wikipedia seems to put it in 911 with the ascension of our main topic today, the king Adad-nirari II. There are reasons for justifying all of these, but the truth is that though scholars disagree on the topic, there's relatively little debate on the matter. This is because nearly all historians agree that when precisely the Neo-Assyrian Empire begins is of little importance, because the Neo-Assyrian Empire never existed. There was only an Assyrian kingdom, which ran all the way from the great kings of the late Bronze Age until its ultimate fall in the final years of the 600s BCE. Though the fortunes of Assyria rose and fell in those years, continuity is very much the name of the game in terms of how the Assyrians saw their nation. The reason, incidentally, why people pick different start dates for this thing they call Neo-Assyria is that depending on what aspects of history you're studying, the key markers and historical evidences really do pick up at different times. As far as I'm concerned, Ashur-dan had enough narrative that we can really see the trajectory change from the Dark Age into the first growth period of the late empire. But we will be seeing significantly more sources with each successive king, and there's simply more that we can say about both Assyria and the Near East under Adad-nirari, and far more yet to say and study under Ashurnasirpal and his successors. So you'll likely see multiple different start dates for the Neo-Assyrian Empire. Just know that nearly all of them are legitimate, as long as they're somewhere between like 950 and 850 BCE. And at the same time, none of them are real markers, because the foundation of the empire was marked fundamentally by continuity, and no one at the time realized that they were necessarily entering into a new historical era. Having decided that we don't know when the Neo-Assyrian Empire began, let us further wade into some nonsensical pedantry by pointing out that we don't actually know if the Neo-Assyrian Empire was, in fact, an empire. You will hear the claim that it was the world's first empire, and sometimes this is because the writer or speaker just doesn't know about the Akkadian Empire, which preceded it by almost a millennium, over a millennium, actually. But more often, the issue around empire is that there exists a significant disagreement about what exactly is an empire. Unlike the dating issue, this does get far more heated because it gets picked up by people trying to make points about colonialism and other modern political issues. But the truth is that we just don't have a good definition for the word empire. And this is a case where having the real dictionary definition is unhelpful. Properly speaking, an empire is a government run by the Latin legal doctrine of imperium, and the word, by that definition, can only cover the Roman Empire, since no other government before or since has been run on the same Latin legal code in quite the same way. Now, go start fights in the comments as to whether the Byzantines count as a separate empire, the same empire, or not an empire, and how significant the legal reforms of Justinian were. But really, this is not a very helpful word. It's too restrictive to cover common usage. But then, if we start expanding our definition of empire, we have to confront the fact that some consider just any large country to be an empire, which I think is going too far in the other direction. Indeed, for some people, anything can be that's powerful and wide-reaching can be an empire, causing the Nestle Corporation or BTS fans or George Soros' political contributions to all being labeled as empires. And while it is incontestable that this is a definition of empire used in the English language, it's hardly very useful. Now, I don't like too much linguistic pedantry, so I'm happy to use a pretty common and fairly loose idea of empire, wherein it's basically a nation which rules over other nations. The Assyrians, in this case, come through, take over the non-Assyrians, and there exists a hierarchy between Assyrians and non-Assyrians. Sometimes the subject groups are encouraged to assimilate into the dominant group, occasionally leading to odd situations like the historical situation in France, where you once had a multilinguistic set of nations ruled from Paris in the early Middle Ages, which became, by the modern period, a fairly homogenized single nation state. China has similarly evolved over the centuries, though even with 95% of the population assimilated into Han Chinese ethnicity, they still rule over significant fringes of other nations not yet fully integrated. This definition does get odd in some cases. For instance, it would class classical Sparta as an empire due to the idea of the Helots as members of a separate nation, but it works quite well for the three great empires of Mesopotamia: the Akkadians, the Assyrians, and the Babylonians. And then, of course, the Persians and the Greeks after that, who we're not going to cover. And it is important that Assyria is perhaps the first nation to realize and really try to make sense of its imperial status. The Akkadians didn't really appear to wrestle with their multi-ethnic makeup. They just made everyone work in Akkadian whether they liked it or not, and the Hittites kind of went the exact opposite way, with such radical indifference to the various cultures that they ruled over, that there was little to hold the empire together once it started falling apart. And the very idea of Hittite eventually became this weird semi-political label existing orthogonal to ethnicity. The Assyrians, though, are going to be the first people expressly operating in what we think of nowadays as an imperial manner. Now, we're going to get deeper into what exactly that means. We've got a lot of empire to cover. We're going to see a lot of different facets of it. But we already see it to a certain extent from Ashur Dan, and before him from the Middle Assyrian kings. The land from Ashur expands, swallowing more and more territory. Subject peoples from more and more cultures and nations are brought into the widening empire, plus also the deportations bring people into the empire even without necessarily expanding its territory. On the other hand, proper people of Ashur go out to exploit the land and people with ideological and religious fervor. In a way, we're going to see the Assyrians being more intentional about their empire building than even the Romans, who are our model of empire, since they're not going to pretend at any point in this process that their empire was accidental. They're going to pronounce it as the will of God for the organization of the entire universe. Anyway, all that aside, we've probably by now laid the foundation for what will become the Assyrian Empire. Ashur Dan dies, apparently peacefully, in the year 911 BCE, and his son, Adad-nirari II, takes power. But that date gets us into one more tangent before our story properly starts. You see, for this entire show, all the dates that I've been given have always been approximate. I've mentioned this a few times, but as we move forward in history, we're getting closer and closer to getting accurate dates for things. However, now that we're at 911 BCE, we actually have dates that are 100% accepted by the scholarly community. There's no high or low set of dates. There's very little circa. And we have a full list of eponyms. Now, we have become fairly familiar with the two ways of counting years in southern Mesopotamia. There was the old Sumerian style, which was common until the old Babylonian period, which was the fascinating practice of year names. Every year used to have a name like the year that so-and-so defeated this or that enemy, or the year the king performed this religious ritual, or the year that some big canal or thing or whatever was constructed. This was a pretty unwieldy system, but it's fantastic for historians. But around the old Babylonian period, they just started counting by years of the most recent king, so the 3rd or the 5th or the 12th year of King so-and-so. Not as exciting, but certainly simpler. But up in Assyria, they didn't use either method, at least not after 2000 BC or so. From the oldest days of the Assyrian merchant empire, the city government had a certain official called the Limmu. He was a kind of important guy, but he wasn't necessarily the mayor or the king or anything like that. The mayor or king could sometimes be the Limmu, but it was a separate position, and each year only one person held that position. Nominally, this guy was responsible for organizing the New Year's festival, may have been involved in the collection of taxes or fines, but aside from that, it's hard to kind of tell what exactly the position entailed. It seems that frequently the position was held by people who had other administrative roles in the government. And of course, in the period we're now at, sometimes the king himself would be the limum, usually the first or second, later on the fourth year of the king's rule becomes the traditional year for him to be the eponym. And so it's hard to disentangle our records of these people with the position. But the key to the position is that it was held for exactly 1 year at a time. And as far as we know, there was a limum every year for the entire history of the city of Asher. Then, whoever was limum from the year would lend his name to the year. So things would be dated as the year of Nergal-Alekpani, or the year of Shamash-Abua, and so on. This, in turn, required that a list of all Limmu officials be kept in the central records of the city of Asher, and in later imperial times it required that the Limmu be announced annually to all the provinces. As far as we know, these Limmu lists were kept faithfully for over 15 centuries, throughout the entire history of the city of Asher. Though, of course, most of these lists are now lost or fragmentary. However, from the year 911 to the 630s-ish, we have reliable lists that cover every year, meaning we know the exact sequence and reign length for all the kings and many notable events. Then we can anchor that list in time because we know the exact day of a certain solar eclipse. It gets called the Berg-Sagale eclipse because that's the year it took place, and correlating our modern astronomical calculations with the records of the event, we can be about as certain as anything that this eclipse was seen in Asher on July 15th, 763 BCE. And so, with that anchor, and a complete listing of the Limmu for the Assyrian period, we can now date events quite confidently. Now, this doesn't mean we can date everything. Many events are recorded without reference to a particular date, aside from which king was in charge at the time, sometimes not even that. So there is still an amount of speculation and reconstruction in the history. But for example, with Adad-Nirari today, we can go year by year, and sometimes specify particular months and days when things occurred, because we finally have enough context to put a year to each Limmu. Anyway, all that is the explanation for how we know that Adad-Nirari II came to power in 911 BCE. His name means Adad is my helper. By the edict of the great gods, in that year, his sovereignty and dominion were decreed, and the gods named him to plunder the possessions of the lands. Because yes, that is the job of the king, to plunder the possessions of the lands. We hear from his second annals that he had no shortage of consideration for himself. We hear him proclaim, "I am king, I am lord, I am powerful, I am important, I am praiseworthy, I am magnificent, I am strong, I am mighty, I am fierce, I am enormously radiant, I am a hero, I am a warrior, I am a virile lion, I am foremost, I am exalted, I am raging." And if you repeat that to yourself in the mirror each morning, it'll either boost your confidence or give you an outrageous personality disorder. How much of this, though, is his underlying personality, and how much is the sort of presentation that's expected of an Assyrian king? We're going to see going forward that's often unclear. Indeed, we can see by this point that the propaganda and expected presentation of an Assyrian king is now so well established that it's hard to get at the underlying person behind all the bombast. And it's often going to obscure our view of what the events actually are. Still, we make do with what we have, and I suspect, based on what we know from later rulers, that these kings, most of whom had been groomed for rulership from birth, had been nurtured throughout their lives to adopt the persona of king to such an extent that I genuinely think that most of them fitted the stereotype, at least to a certain degree. That is to say, whoever was underneath the mask of Assyrian king, I think Adad-nirari and most of the other kings wore the mask of proud ruler so often that it shaped their actual personality. But of course, at the end of the day, that's all just speculation. What isn't speculation is that Adad-nirari had no chill. The moment he takes the crown, he musters the chariots and infantry, conquers the minor Aramaean kingdom of Komanu, captures the king, slaughters the royal family, and plunders the kingdom. We have no idea why. Had there been some offense? Were they just the closest and the weakest? We're told it was by the command of the god Asher, which tells us that some amount of divination was involved. It could well be that the divination priest constructed a list of all nearby nations, then tossed some sticks or bones the way that we might flip a coin, and the result came up heads most often for the land of Kumanu. But once the conquest was over, Adad-nirari did not want the enemy destroyed. Because really, they weren't the enemy. They were just resources to be collected. He was in this way like his father. The initial violence is like chopping a tree with an axe. It's necessary to subdue the people and get them into the form Asher would like, but then Adad-nirari respectfully takes the Kumanan gods into the temple of Asher, where they were subjugated to the great god Asher, but then incorporated into the wider Assyrian pantheon. Similarly, the soldiers who surrendered and gave up the fight were incorporated into the Assyrian population. They were given the status of Sabu, which we usually render as deportee, but it doesn't really have a translation, save that it's less in status than a full Assyrian citizen, but it's better than that of a slave. Now, this isn't what we would today call benevolence, but the Assyrians saw themselves as benevolent towards properly submissive conquered people, much the same way as abusers are often extremely nice when they are getting their way in a relationship. Anyway, he takes Kumanu, which is likely somewhere on the Tigris River. Then he goes the other direction on the Tigris and takes some 40 towns from various Aramaeans there as well. He notes that only 3 of the towns actually resisted, the others just surrendered, letting us know that the Assyrians are already developing a certain reputation, one which they are happy to weaponize. Thus far, he's either in the same general area as his father was fighting in, or he's only pushing the border forward just a single step. In his second year, he continued the fight in a number of nearby lands, generally to the east, between the Tigris and the Iranian mountains. But in all of these, he claims to have brought back plunder and captives. But it's not clear about whether or not he incorporated the land into the empire the way he clearly did with the Kumanu. Finally, with all this plunder, he did some public improvements in Asshur, repairing the quay along the river. Then he wrote his first annals and had it published around the kingdom, so that everyone would know that he was only 3 years into this whole being king business, and already had proved himself quite successful. But Adad-Nirari is only getting started. He has 15 very busy years left in his reign. In these first few years, between what we've already seen and some gaps in the annals, he builds on what his father conquered and solidifies Assyrian control over the entire Upper Tigris region, bounded generally by the mountains to the north and east. Assyria then reaches west, sort of towards the Khabur region, but a hold in that direction remains a bit uncertain, and actually in the Khabur is still only vassal kings for now, and only in part of that region. At this point, the best direction for him to expand is south, but he's now butting up against the borders of the land of Babylon. Now, we know very little about what Babylon's up to at the moment, and in fact, we only know the name of the current king, Shamash-Mumadik, because of his appearance in the coming battle. We assume that Babylon is in pretty bad shape, and this is confirmed because as the Assyrians move south, the Babylonian army is crushed attempting to resist them. And it seems that the Babylonian king Shamash-Mumadik dies in the battle. Oh, Shamash-Mumadik, we hardly knew you. Anyway, Adad-Nirari in the aftermath didn't take Babylon itself, but pushed the border much further south than it had been for a very, very long time, taking the Diyala River Valley for Assyria, the city of Dur, and a number of other important northern towns. Down in Babylon, we don't know how they took this, but the new king, whose name is either Nabu-Shuma-Ukin or Nabu-Shuma-Ishkun, the sources differ, takes the throne and begins a campaign of internal development, and possibly military reform as well. Satisfied with victory, Adad-Nirari turns away from the south, leaving governors in place to establish the conquered regions into Assyrian provinces, and moves to focus more heavily on the Nairi lands. Now, we don't have a very good timeline of his Nairi campaigns. We mostly hear about his fourth campaign, and we have no record of all of the first three. But if he marched into the difficult terrain of the Armenian Plateau that often, it must have eaten up a significant chunk of his attention for at least 4 years, and quite possibly more. While on campaign in the mountains, it would have been extremely difficult for messages to reach him from the capital, and given the still growing and unsettled state of the kingdom, it would at the very least have left him vulnerable to threat from within, or from external threats coming from other directions. As it so happened, he either figured out how to plan for these things, or he just got lucky and didn't get challenged from these directions, so we can focus more fully on the Nairi. Now, I've been asked previously about Urartu. It seems that a number of modern people who live in and around the border of Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and Armenia are quite interested in them as ancestors or claimed ancestors. The topic gets extremely heated online, and I honestly didn't really realize this at first until fairly recently. I mean, I knew there existed both Kurdish and Armenian claims to at least some ancestral connection to Urartu, but there's also a sense of denial of this connection, and that denial is directly related to endorsing or enabling both the historic Ottoman-Turkish genocides of the Armenians or the ongoing Turkish oppression of the Kurds, or the wider Muslim attacks on Armenians and modern Assyrians, and various such things. Like, I really didn't know all that much about it, and I made a couple videos on TikTok, and the absolute astonishing vitriol of seemingly normal Muslim people against the modern descendants of the Urartians and the Assyrians is absolutely shocking. And I guess it makes sense because there are active and increasing genocide campaigns against the Assyrians and Armenians nowadays, and the Kurds. It's really, really kind of depressing. I like to stick to things that were thousands of years ago because it's just easier to deal with. Like, oh, this Assyrian king, he slaughtered a bunch of people. That's history. Right now, this is people seriously suffering, people seriously dying, even archaeological sites getting destroyed en masse. I've read that the Taliban is destroying one archaeological site a week in Afghanistan, and that's an understudied area. They're destroying things that we're never going to learn about. Well, it's kind of depressing. Anyway, I'm not going to focus on that stuff if I can avoid it, since all I'm certain of is that the Nairi and the Urartu existed 3,000 years ago, and that the Armenians, Kurds, and Assyrians exist now. And there were connections between the ancient peoples and the modern peoples, and it's silly to deny it as part of a denial of the modern people, because even if the Assyrians were faking it, as the Muslims claim, it's astonishing. It's the modern Muslims, even seemingly normal people on TikTok who are not actively, I hope, not actively murdering anybody. They go, oh, these Assyrians, they're not the ancient Assyrians. So we can murder them all and take their homes and enslave their women and sell the Yazidis as slaves, actual slaves. Just because we are denying the fact that they have connections to the ancient peoples here. And it's like, on one hand, no, they do seem to have connections. The Urartu Armenian connection is harder to establish clearly. But even if there's not a connection, and I'm not too focused on that because I don't really care about modern people's ancestries, you can't just go around killing people for that. Anyway, a bunch of Muslims killing a bunch of people in the Middle East. Breaking news. It's never happened before for the last 1,400 years. Where was I? Anyway, it's far from clear who or what the Nairi were. In some texts, they come across as sort of this loose coalition of kings living in the Armenian region. And of course, we have to bring it up again. The Armenian region is not the modern nation of Armenia. The modern nation of Armenia is a tiny fraction of the Armenian region, which extends way south into modern-day Turkey and Iran. And of course, they were persecuted and genocided for 1,400 years for the crime of being Christians in a Muslim area. So we're talking about the Armenian region just because that's geographically what it is. But in some texts, they just seem like a group of different people that have come together for mutual defense and mutual trade. In other texts, they sound more like an actual ethnic group, though not a particularly united ethnic group. We see them emerge following the collapse of the Mitanni kingdom. Our first mention of them seems to be when the Assyrian king Shalmaneser invades sometime around 1260. And this is pretty typical for the entire region of Armenia in this ancient period. Though they were certainly literate, writing at least in Hurrian cuneiform, they most likely wrote on wood and parchment, which has decayed, or on metal plates, which have largely been plundered and melted down by successive generations. Nearly all we hear about these people groups is when other, more well-documented peoples attack them, with an exception for the very peak of Urartian civilization. Anyway, following the Mitanni collapse, the region around Armenia was something of a mix of Hurrians and more recent immigrants and a substrate of peoples who were more indigenous than the Hurrians, with the Nairi being principally probably that most indigenous substrate, but with many Hurrians intermixed. The Mitanni to Nairi transition doesn't seem to have radically upended the way of life in those mountains, which seems to have largely gone on a tribal and village basis, regardless of who was in charge or who was immigrating in. And with the Bronze Age collapse and the centuries which followed, there were clearly new entrants into the regions, though exactly who they were, how they integrated, and where they settled is hard to see from the relatively limited archaeological work done in the region. Their way of life, from what we can tell, appears fairly unexceptional for mountain folk of the era. A foundation of agriculture allowed for a degree of civilization, though the surpluses were never enough to build the great cities like we saw in Mesopotamia and Egypt. And this was supplemented by pastoralists in the marginal lands, likely a degree of hunting and gathering, and then preyed on by bandits who were, at their most sophisticated, barely distinguishable from the governments of the towns. The thing which distinguished them economically was mostly their access to metals and stone. They were frequently visited by traders from Mesopotamia, giving them access to southern goods in exchange for their efforts at mining valuable metals. This eventually leveraged into the mountain folk gaining a reputation for smithing of all sorts, since profits are always far higher for finished goods than for raw materials. Material wealth plus a defensible position could, in many periods of history, set the people of the Armenian plateau up for a relatively nice living situation. However, with Assyria just to the south, both of those things would continuously draw the attention of the lowland kings. Adad-nirari is pretty much case in point here. In his multiple Nairi campaigns, we see on one hand the cost of sending armies into such difficult terrain, but also the key strategic benefits to doing so. Before the Assyrians actually reached Nairi lands, they confronted a variety of Aramaean groups, who had, it seems, been living in the foothills and southern reaches of the mountains, and using the land as a natural fortress. From these bases, the Aramaeans could ride south and plunder the relatively less defended and wealthier lowlands with near impunity. This security threat plagued the entire Assyrian northern border, now that two kings had expanded their territory to cover the whole of the lowlands there. And so Adad-nirari took great pride in attacking these peoples and towns, taking hostages, defeating their armies, and then importantly, imposing tribute and tax, not wholly emptying the lands, so that those who would remain would be properly subject to Asher, and not a mere no man's land that might risk getting filled up again with bandits in future generations. At least, it seems to have been the hope. But with these foothills secured, it's not that much farther to go to grab some free metals from the Nairi. Sure, at this point, the Assyrians seem to have been stable enough that they could have afforded to purchase metals from their northern neighbors, and likely they did most of the time, both before and after the attacks. But from an Assyrian perspective, there's little reason to buy something when you can just take it through blood and slaughter. Plus, each time they go up, they're able to establish more and more Nairi communities as tributaries to get even more free metals as time went on. But now that we've learned a bit about the Nairi, it's time to more or less bid them farewell. This is basically the last time we're going to be hearing from them in history. We haven't said much because there's not that much to be said, and what can be said about their material conditions mostly comes from what we know about the Urartu when we get to them in a few decades. This campaign by Adad Nirari seems to have broken whatever bond held the Nairi coalition together, with many of them now tributaries, and the remaining tribes and towns too broken and scattered to unify effectively. It's in this context that we see the genesis of Urartu. Now, there is a debate as to whether Urartu is hundreds of years old by this point. Shalmaneser I, back in the 1260s or so, attacked a people in the Armenian highlands called the Urartu, and given the inconsistency of ancient spellings and the shifts in language over the centuries, Urartu could well be the same people as the ancient, or as the later Urartians. Or, by the same token, it could be two different people with similar names, or it could be a different set of people, both taking a local geographic name in different centuries, rather like the ancient Macedonians of Alexander the Great's time and the Slavic northern Macedonians today, both taking a geographic name, but not actually having any relation to each other. And I'm going to get banned off YouTube for these hot takes today. I don't know what's gotten into me. More importantly, the possibility of connection doesn't really matter much at this point because we only have the isolated reference to the older people and nothing's actually known about these Urartu except that they got attacked by the Assyrians. And frankly, getting attacked by Assyrians doesn't make anyone special. However, it's in the aftermath of these attacks by Adad Nirari that one tribe or kingdom, called Urartu, situated near the eastern shores of Lake Van up in the mountains, begins a multi-decade-long push to swallow up the other tribes and towns in the region. The whole process is, as usual, obscure to us, but it is fairly rapid, especially given the difficulty of moving around in the region. Here, around 900, the process clearly hasn't started yet. But by 860, the foundations of the Urartian kingdom will already be present. And when we are able to say more about Urartu, a lot of the cultural and material background that we talk about there will have applied to a certain extent to the Nairi. So, if you're interested in that, just hold on, we'll get there. Anyway, that's where we are now, just around 900 BCE. Ashurdan led Assyria out of the Dark Age, and Adad Nirari has built upon his success, conquering the upper Tigris Valley all the way to the mountains and beyond. And down south, he's asserted his dominance over Babylon. In the west, his domain extends to the edge of the Khabur region. I'm going to cut it here, since episodes were originally only supposed to be 30 minutes long, and episode lengths have been creeping up on me for a while. So join us next time as we close out Adad Nirari's reign with 8 separate campaigns in an expansive and detailed attempt to clear out the Aramaeans of the Khabur Triangle. Then watch in fascination as he gets his teeth kicked in by an enemy we long thought since defeated. Thank you for listening.